Chair calls the Education Finance Committee to order for Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. A couple of quick things before I go to the roll call. Welcome, Representative Sensenmeyer. And I see you have a guest. So I hear the cuteness factor is way off the charts. So
congratulations.
So welcome. And before I go to the roll call as well, Representative Clardy, three words for you. Love is blind, do tell. Go ahead.
Let's see. How do you say that where you can't say anything legally? Thank you.
Well, looks like it's a great opportunity. So with that, members, we do have a Ms. Volka, we have a quorum present. We do have a quorum present. And with that, Representative Bennett, will you move to approve the minutes, please? Have you had a chance to review them?
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Minutes are approved. Any discussion? And approved. Representative Bennett moves to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Members, we have a full agenda, and I'm going to switch up the orders just a little bit and talk. Chair Joaquin, we're going to have Representative Anderson and Representative Hill present House Files 52 and 53 first. My intent is to get them through, lay the bill over, and then get quickly to House File 6, get through the testimony on that, and at 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock, I want to give a full 45 minutes, or as close to 45 minutes of discussion for the members to get through the bill. So if you can help me with that, that's the goal. So with that, members will now proceed to the two bills on the agenda, House Files 52 and 53. I believe you have testifiers here. I will ask that you choose which one you want to go first and bring your first testifier up.
All right. Well,
I can't see him. Dr. Olson, if you want to start us off, you came the furthest to be here today. So,
Dr. Olson, welcome to the committee. State your name and for the record and give a quick testimony, please.
Yes, I'm Jeremy Olson, superintendent of Majeri Schools.
And maybe before Dr. Olson presents, just a quick introduction of the bill itself.
This Representative Hill, to your bill.
House File 52 and 53 both seek to address an issue for our large geographical districts. And I just wanted to take a moment to introduce the bills in the critical investment our districts need that are, you know, transporting students further than their neighboring districts. And the financial challenges this leads to our large geographical districts, it forces many of them to make programming cuts and leaves many students around the great state of Minnesota behind. And so in the last biennium, I was proud to be a part of the effort, along with Representative Anderson, to raise that funding from 18% of each of these large districts' transportation deficit up to 35%. Today we'll be hearing from three superintendents to share their own stories of how this current reality places their individual districts at a disadvantage. And so with that, I do want to turn it over to Dr. Olson, who's so kind to join us all the way from Bemidji, to share a little bit about some of the challenges that they're facing. We'll also be Dr. Funk and Dr. Massey from Stillwater and Forest Lake Schools, respectively.
And Representative Anderson, do you have any comments?
I'll just be brief. We apologize that this are bills 52 and 53. We got our things crossed. We both had the same bill, and we had talked. And so they really are the same or similar. And we hope that you support this. We worked on this bipartisan last session. We got a little bit, little closer, and we hope to get a little closer again because this is such a huge issue for our schools. And we're taking dollars out of the classroom or getting rid of bus routes altogether, adding more miles on the roads and so on because of this. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Dr. Olson.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for the work that you guys do on behalf of Minnesota. As a superintendent, we certainly appreciate, for my district and many districts around the state, we appreciate the good work you guys do. We understand that you have a lot of responsibility, and we certainly want to thank you for that good work. It was a long, cold drive from Bemidji, Minnesota this morning, so I want to emphasize that too, but it is certainly worth it to spend a little bit of time with you guys to talk through why this is such an important bill and why we're bringing this forward to you today. So first of all, thank you, Chair and members of the Education Finance Committee. My name is Jeremy Olson, and I'm the superintendent of Majeri Schools. This is my third year with the school district, and we have been, during those, that time, I've been faced with some unique challenges that are faced by several districts, which is what this bill looks to address, which is our current transportation funding formula. I am grateful to Representative Anderson and Hill for supporting this bill, which seeks to decrease the disparity between what we receive in revenue and what we expend expenses for transportation due to our large transportation area. I'm also thankful that HF 5253 helps districts that need it while not taking away from any of the districts that are currently benefiting from the transportation formula. HF 5253 proposes a solution to bring districts like mine closer to whole while also ensuring that no district is harmed. I think that's an important note there. This does not create winners and losers. This really just looks at those districts that are already in a deficit from a transportation standpoint. Bemidji Area School District serves approximately 4,800 students from pre-K through grade 12. We provide transportation services for 20 sites spread out over 825 square miles. We serve 11 public, a juvenile detention center, 4 charter schools, and 4 private schools. So we're pretty diverse up there in Bemidji. There's a map that is actually in your packet that when we overlay that on the metro area, it gives you a little perspective of how large our district is in comparison to other districts. So if you look at that map, there's a square black line, or that's a little square there that's about the size of the city of Bemidji. And that is that right there is the school district, Richfield, has the same population, so therefore gets the same transportation funding as Bemidji Area Schools. If you look at the larger, much larger portion of the map that outline, that's Bemidji Area Schools. So as you can see there, we are transporting the same number of students, many, many more miles than you'll see in some other districts, which creates some efficiency challenges for us. In addition to that, you throw in some lakes, you throw in some areas that roads aren't always straight, right? That also causes some concerns. So we are a very large district from a geography standpoint. We must transport within that geography as well. So if you look at my school district, you can see that we have a large footprint there that we have to transport. But we also have the same number of students as Richfield, or approximately. So if you look at that, we have to be a little bit more inefficient. Unless we were going to have kids on the bus for 3 hours, which we feel is unacceptable, to keep transportation rides manageable, we have to expend more dollars than comparison districts.
And Mr. Olson, if you could wrap it up.
Absolutely. So because we're such a large district, we do have to look at this transportation bill. Similar to Forest Lake and other schools, we are required to provide funding for all schools in our district, including charter and private schools, and we would ask that you provide support for this important funding so we can fulfill our mandate instead of taking it out of K-12 dollars, because any dollars that are transferred from our general fund, when they're transferred, those dollars come out of our K-12 budget. So thank you very much for your support.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Olson. Mr. Massey from Forest Lake, if you can come up. And Mr. Funk, you'll be on deck. Mr. Massey, if you could state your name for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Yes, Steve Massey, Superintendent for Forest Lake Area Schools. Mr. Chair and representatives, thank you for this opportunity this morning or this afternoon to testify on behalf of House File 52 and 53. Representatives Anderson and Hill, thank you for your leadership on this critical issue. Briefly, the issues related to school transportation funding inequities go all the way back to 1995, when the legislature changed transportation funding to a per pupil basis rather than a metric that covered the real cost incurred by school districts to transport their students. Transportation sparsity aid was added to help districts that were negatively impacted by this change. In the 2023 legislature, the sparsity formula was increased from 18.2% of the district's deficits to 35% of district transportation deficits. While we are grateful for this increase, it still leaves a deficit of 65%. Forest Lake Area Schools is a district just 25 miles north of St. Paul, Minneapolis. Our district covers approximately 220 square miles with an enrollment of just under 6,000 students. On an average day, our 55 bus routes cover a two-tiered system and as a total, drive over 5,500 miles each day. This is the distance between Key West and Anchorage every day. As I stated a moment ago, transportation is based on student enrollment, not the miles a district must drive to transport students. Consequently, districts with large geography and dispersed housing, like Forest Lake and many other similar districts, must offset their transportation costs from the general fund. Specifically, Forest Lake draws approximately $500,000 from the general fund every year to cover this transportation deficit. And over the last 15 years, that's $7.5 million we've drawn from the general fund. To offset this cost, we've reduced 8 bus routes in just the last 2 years, resulting in longer bus rides for students, and as a result, many more parents driving their kids because the bus rides now are over an hour, up to an hour and 20 minutes each way. We now have some students ride the bus, as I indicated, for 2 to 2.5 hours from morning route to the afternoon route. The issue is an issue of fairness. $500,000 is equivalent to 7 teachers or critical services we are not able to provide for our students. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify. And if you have any questions, we'd be happy at some point to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Massey. Appreciate your testimony and your comments. Mr. Funk. And Superintendent Funk, if you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Carisha. Mike Funk, Superintendent, Stillwater Area Public Schools. I'm here today to testify in support of House Files 52 and 53. Stillwater Area Public Schools serves 18 communities across 153 square miles, making transportation a critical operational challenge. Our district transports 8,073 students every single day to ensure access to education for a widely dispersed student population. Given the geographic spread, our transportation system is not just a convenience, it is a necessity for equitable education. Our district operates with a 1% fund balance, leaving minimal flexibility to absorb unexpected costs. Last year, we spent over $12 million on transportation, exceeding our budgeted expenditures by $1.5 million. Transportation cost overruns are a primary negative impact on our district funding, diverting critical resources from classroom instruction and student services. We also made a reduction of about 7 routes this past school year as well to try to maintain as much balance with our transportation expenses as we could. Unlike our urban school districts with dense student populations, sparsely populated districts face longer routes, higher fuel expenses, and greater wear and tear on buses. Fixed costs such as driver salaries, maintenance, and fuel do not scale proportionately with student population density, disproportionately straining rural school district budgets. We would like our state funding formula to take this into account in consideration with the proposal in this bill. We are asking you consider this bill so that we can continue to provide efficient transportation in an effective manner that helps us balance our budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Funk, for your comments and your testimony. Appreciate it. And with that, members and testifiers, that concludes the testimony. Representative Chair Uwakim, do you have a couple comments before I go to the close?
Yeah, actually, I have a question, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Strom or
Mr.
Solveig to go through the spreadsheet in our packets, just so people know how to read it, or so I know how to read it.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, in your packet, is document labeled Estimated Data 25-26 School Year Transportation Sparsity Adjustment. Like most printouts, in the first column, it shows the pupil units, and then following that, there's a column called the Qualifying Transportation Expenditures. A school district's transportation expenditures are either the lesser of the current the previous year's expenditures, in this case, fiscal year 25, or 1.05 times the 24 expenditures. So that first data column after the pupil units, which totals $445 million, is the eligible transportation expenditures. The next column adds the revenue amounts up, which include the transportation sparsity revenue, as well as 4.66% of the formula allowance, which was the amount set aside as transportation money during the 1995 changes that the testifier mentioned. You can see that totals $3 million of qualifying revenue. And for those with a difference, you can see in the next column $50 million of essentially unfunded transportation expenditures are spread amongst the various districts. The next category over shows the baseline transportation sparsity revenue, followed by the per pupil amount of that. And you can see, as the testifier said, that for those small geographically isolated districts, there's relatively large amounts of transportation sparsity revenue. But as the district has a transportation or a municipal center like Bemidji or otherwise has a student count that leads to a less sparse district but still with the miles to cover, those amounts go down fairly substantially. You can see there in the last three columns then what the base amount of the transportation sparsity adjustment is. So out of that $99 million of total transportation sparsity revenue, currently 35% of the qualifying difference, or $17.5 million, is in that category that's currently funded as part of the transportation formula. Both Representative Anderson and Hill's bill proposed to increase that amount to 70%, which is the second to last column, and you can see that doubles the amount so that there'd be a total of $35 million for that adjustment. And the last column then shows how much of an aid increase per individual district there is. And the districts on the spreadsheet are listed in ascending district number order. So for those that benefit from this change, you can see the relative dollar amount of that. As a reminder, District 31 is Bemidji, and districts 833 and 831 to 834 are the Washington County districts that were mentioned as well.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Chair Ewing-King.
Mr. Chair, one last thing, too. I know we talked about this when we did raise it from 17 to 35%, but that density that kind of throws off the formula wouldn't be fixed with this bill. Is that correct? Or we probably have to still look at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, I believe by increasing the amount of the qualifying difference, the amount of the unfunded transportation that's paid for, is a way of fixing that. So the district's determining how much is it having to use of its other general fund money, and then paying a higher percent of that fixes the problem regardless of the way that the underlying formula works. It's a little like how a cross-subsidy formula works.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
And thank you, Chair Joachim. And Representative Ray Brower, I see you're on the list, but I am going to go to the closing, and then if you want to catch them afterwards, please do so I can get to House File 6. With that, Representative Anderson, Representative Hill, close to your bill, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Carisha. I just wanted to point out that in 2019, the Finance Task Force looked at this issue, and their recommendation for the education committees at that time was to move this up to 70% of that deficit. And so that is what our legislation here is hoping to accomplish as we continue to work on this important issue. Thank you to our testifiers.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Like Representative Hill said, you know, we're asking to get to the 70 because we're not asking to get to the 100. We will take whatever we can get. We understand that there is, dollars are not like they were 2 years ago. But this is really, really important because these school districts are being harmed. They're getting you know, losing money. It's coming out of general education program. And, you know, if you care about wear and tear on the roads or transit or, you know, this is causing significantly more trips because parents are driving their kids to school rather than having them on the bus for an hour and a half, because that's the option right now. And I have to say, even with excess dollars, is still not going to get all these bus trips under an hour. But it's going to help. It's going to help. So thank you, and we ask for your support. So
thank you, Representative Anderson. And so a little bit of housekeeping. Representative Hill moves House File 52 before the committee, and the chair lays House File 52 over for possible inclusion in an omnibus at a later time. And Representative Hill, you're going to get another one. Representative Hill moves House File 53 before the committee, and the chair lays House File 53 over for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill at a later time. So thank you both for your testimony. And with that, members, we're going to move to House File 6. Representative Bennett, Representative Mueller, and Representative Bakeberg, if you'll please move to the testifier stand. And Representative Anderson and Representative Hill, don't forget to catch up with Representative Ray Ryer, who had a question.
Washington.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bennett, would you like to move the House File 6 in front of the committee to be placed on the general register?
I would, Mr. Chair. I move House File 6 as amended be placed on the general register.
Can't quite do an amendment yet, but we'll do that now. Representative Bennett, I believe amended. You have an author's amended. Amendment.
Yes, I do.
So members, to get the bill in the shape, Representative Bennett prefers. Representative Bennett, would you like to move the A2 amendment and explain your...
Yes, I move the A2 amendment. And this amendment addresses a concern that was raised in education policy.
Hang on 1 second. So Representative Bennett moves the A2 amendment. Representative Bennett, to your amendment.
Thank you. So it's the fund transfer in Article 3 is limited by any federal restrictions. Excuse me. The option for the mandate relief in Article 3 is also limited by any federal restrictions, so the funding transfer would be limited as well. And that's basically what it does and addresses the concern brought up in the previous committee.
Okay, very good.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't quite hear. I had a question on that last line on the amendment. Line, got to get to the right place. I like, had all the spreadsheets before. Line 1.7. What exactly does that do?
Representative Bennett?
That's if you give me 1 second here, we will look at that.
And that was line 1.7?
7 on the amendment.
1.7. And if you want, let's go to a nonpartisan staff while we're waiting. Ms. Parra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. That is a correction. That is the list of, that line has one of the laws, one of the chapters of law that a district could choose to delay compliance with. And the author's intention was to have all of Article 12, not just Section 4. Section 4 was definitions. But Article 12 is the Earn Sick and Safe Time article.
Mary Joaquin, does that answer your question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So then are we going to, is there going to be another author's amendment to fix that? Or did we get, okay, it's fine. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And Chair, I was so distracted, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Did I hear you say that you're going to move this to the general register?
Correct. The motion is to the general register.
Mr. Chair, there should be a fiscal note with this then. Otherwise, why did it come to us?
At this point, Chair Joaquin, thank you. We have not received a fiscal note. I have talked to Chair Torkelson, and if we get a fiscal note on this and if that comes up, he's agreed that we could pull it back into Ways and Means.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll move to other things after testifiers. Very good.
I'm sure we'll have plenty of discussion. It's good. Representative Bennett, so we have your bill in front of us. We have the amendment, so I'm going to go to a vote. So all those in favor of the author's amendment, the A2, say nay. Or excuse me, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Bennett, to your bill as amended, House File 6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought you were trying to set up my amendment for failure there, but...
Just trying to move us along.
Thank you. So I'll try to be brief here. House File 6 covers several education priorities of the House Republican Caucus. through this bill, we make it clear that literacy is learning, local control is innovation, and empowered parents are engaged parents. So the bill is divided into three articles, which are presented together in this bill, but it's our intention to actually carry the components in this bill as separate bills, standalone bills in the future. So in Article 1, which we'll get into in depth in just a minute, we focus on our commitment to foundational literacy skills. That would be reading instruction delivered through the science of reading. And Representative Mueller, who's been a leader in our caucus on literacy, will go through that article a bit more in a minute. Article 2, we focus on empowering parents with information and promoting education innovation through local control and flexibility. Representative Bakeberg is going to describe that article in just a few minutes. And in Article 3, which has two sections, we provide flexibility for school boards in both funding and relief from new requirements asked of them during the previous biennium. And I'm just going to briefly go through Article 3. It allows funding flexibility through the fiscal year 2029, which is the 28-29 school year. And under this section, school boards would be allowed to transfer any funds that are not otherwise encumbered or limited by federal law, as long as that transfer does not inadvertently trigger additional state aid or increase a local levy. The second part of Article 3, Section 2, allows for mandate relief through the 28-29 school year. Under this section, school boards would be allowed to delay implementation of any mandate, the new mandates that were imposed upon districts in the 23-24 legislative biennium. And I want to point out that these are delays, not repeals of the mandate. What this does is allow school boards to stagger implementation of the mandates. There were so many of them, and we heard over and over in a previous testimony of many different school personnel that these mandates are, they're just inundated with them, and they cannot implement them well all at once like this. So it allows school boards to make decisions in public, not behind closed doors, through resolution at a public meeting, so it's a community decision to delay or not delay any of the mandates that are listed in this bill. And again, it gives them the ability to implement with fidelity the various mandates. We want them to be able to do a good job and not set them up for failure. So I'm just going to stop there. There may be further questions later. But I would like, Mr. Chair, to ask you to recognize Representative Mueller and then Representative Bakeberg to go over. I always mess your name up. I'm sorry.
Representative Mueller and then Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And if you were with me in Ed Poly, you know that ever a teacher can't turn it off. So if you have your bill in front of you, I would encourage you to follow along. We'll start with Article 1. And Article 1 provides the revision to the READ Act that we have ongoing conversations about. That was enacted during the 23-24 legislative session. The last 2 years, we have seen that literacy is a bipartisan concern and that we believe there should be legislative action. And we saw that after failed reading instruction, we are still finding that our literacy scores are decreasing. After years of deception, the reading charlatans had been exposed and their fraud has been revealed. And through the READ Act, it was designed to make sure that we were holding fast to the science of reading and that we were making sure that our curriculum was and our teacher prep schools were holding fast to the science of reading as well. The READ Act acknowledged a real problem as it was implemented, but right now we know that it is overregulated and underfunded. It is simply almost impossible for our schools to comply with the way that it is written correct right now with the funding that has been provided. I want to acknowledge the good faith work that has been happening over the last couple years and to acknowledge the fact that we began with this to really address a problem that we see all over the state. However, with the 2024 session, some of the good work that was started already started to be rolled back with some of the changes that we saw in the READ Act. To put it simply, Article 1 begins with our commitment to the science of reading and a fundamental belief that every child has the right to read. That's on line 1.25 to 2.23, going through all the specific definitions and including the words science of reading. We have heard from our schools that the Department of Education partnership with CARI, the Center of Applied Research and Educational Improvement, has been, to say the least, limiting to schools. And I would like to direct your attention to a letter that was sent by Rachel from Hopkins about how the rubric process through CARI has unintentionally, actually taken out nationally recognized curriculum as something that, you know, and I've been reading through the rubrics and trying to understand that, but we are seeing that that is happening, and so I would like to direct your attention to that. Because of the fact that much of the direction from CARI has been limiting to schools and accessing critical science of reading curriculum and instructional materials, this process was made worse by new misdirected political goals embedded into the law that distract from our focus on the foundational literacy skills. Therefore, this bill ends the partnership with CARI and directs MDE to take up their primary role in assisting schools. That partnership, according to this bill, will end the 30th of June of this year. We restore the expectation that teachers are not only properly prepared to provide reading instruction grounded in the science of reading, but we also reinstate an assessment to verify this. That's on 9.21 to 9.23. This, as we have talked lots of times, does not have to be a paper pencil test. It does say that it could be a performative test if that's if that has been created, but there needs to be an independent mechanism to verify that our teachers have been properly trained and that someone like Representative Bakeberg doesn't have to keep retraining the teachers that he hires. Let's be blunt about this. Literacy is learning. And when we provide a child with the foundational literacy skills, we empower that child to become lifelong learners. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask that you would please recognize Representative Bakeberg.
Representative Bakeberg. Thank you, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the privilege to represent the school districts of Prior Lake, Jordan, Shakopee, and then Southwest Metro Intermediate District. Article 2 is appropriately entitled Educational Innovation because it focuses primarily on empowering local school districts to innovate to meet their local needs. These revisions in this article shift the power from the Department of Education to our local school boards, our local educators, parents, and the community. When these three or four are at the table making decisions without the heavy hand of bureaucrats and government, really creative and innovative things can happen at our local school districts. First, in Article 2, we direct the Department of Education to create a performance report that is user-friendly for the end user. So that could be teachers, that could be parents, that could be community members. MDE has a lot of really good information available online in the data center and their school report cards, but frankly, it's not easy for the end user to be able to navigate. Those of us that are parents, I'm sure, have experienced that. These reports are, this report, just to be clear, is not a report card. We're not grading schools. We want to empower stakeholders with the critical information they need to make their own determinations. Because empowered parents, empowered community members are engaged parents and engaged community members. Those of us that are educators know that one of the biggest frustrations is a lack of parent involvement. This is one way to support that. Second, the bill identifies a variety of current programs that are buried in statute throughout session laws, such as experimental and applied learning opportunities for students or innovation zones, and put the planning and decision making into the hands of the local school districts, the local educators, not the Commissioner of Education. And we create a new chapter of law for education innovation programs, just like we have a chapter dedicated to teachers. This, the intent of this is to provide clarity for districts to be able to reference in statute the authority that they have to be innovative. Third, we convert the current Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Center within the Department of Education to be the Office of Achievement and Innovation with a very simple, clear mission: to assist districts and charter schools in researching and implementing practices focusing on promoting academic achievement in literacy, reading comprehension, math, numeracy, science, and career readiness. The mission comes with a key limitation that all opinions and guidance issued by the office are advisory and not binding to the local district. Fraud is rampant in Minnesota. We also create this Office of Achievement and Innovation will also serve as a clearinghouse for nonprofits. For far too long, members of these committees in the legislature have picked which nonprofits are funded and which are not, and we need to shift that authority to our local school districts. We need to shift the dynamic of power to our local schools to determine which nonprofits they choose to work with, while leveraging the MDE resources to conduct their due diligence to avoid shady nonprofits that have the goal of taking advantage of our school districts. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Article 2.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. And Representative Bakeberg, Representative Mueller, I'm going to ask you to step aside. We bring our first two testifiers up, and testifiers Denise Dietrich and Kat Briggs, if you'll come up. And to each testifier, I apologize in advance, but we are tight. I will be holding you to 2 minutes for each one and cutting us off at the two-minute mark. Ms. Dietrich, welcome. State your name and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, which serves all 331 school boards across the state. Today I'm speaking on behalf of House File 6, on behalf of school administrators, principals, and business officials. Together, our organizations are responsible for the administration and the financial oversight of this, of all the schools in Minnesota. There are three provisions in this bill that we would like to speak to today. First, under Article 2, is the Education Innovation Section article. Our organizations have long advocated for policies that promote education innovation. The Innovation Zone project is one step in the right direction in this effort. And there are, for those districts who have the time, talent, and resources to implement new education models. We would urge the committee to expand the Innovation Zones program by authorizing the local district to define instructional hours for all high school students. We feel this change would really allow students to earn credit and for schools to retain the funding for personalized education opportunities rather than the traditional seat time. Secondly, under Article 3, titled Funding and Mandates Flexibility, this provision allows a school district to transfer funds between operating accounts under certain restrictions, a long-standing priority for our school districts. At a time when many of our school districts are facing spending cuts, this provision's flexibility will provide some fiscal relief without requiring additional state funding. This flexibility recognizes that local school boards, superintendents are best positioned to work with their business managers to determine and allocate resources where they're needed most, such as addressing the mental health needs in schools, career and technical education, implementing the READ Act, covering the costs of transportation.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Ms. Briggs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kat Briggs, and I'm a school bus driver for Independent School District 196. I'm here specifically to address Article 3, which I believe has some financial concerns for all, including myself. I have had, because of unemployment, the basic same economic security as my boys who work construction, pouring concrete and can't work in the winter. Driving a school bus is not an easy job. We're basically driving a one-room schoolhouse with two classrooms on board. 77 capacity limit on a big bus. It's extra tough in the summer, not just because there's no air conditioning, but during summer school, I work 2 hours in the morning and two more in the afternoon, 4 days a week. That's only 16 hours of work. And of course, there's no work in the weeks when there is no school. Because of unemployment insurance, the weeks when there was school, I got partial unemployment benefits along with my wages. The weeks when there were no routes, I got my full benefit, which is approximately half of my weekly school year income. Growing up, I had the same bus driver from elementary school through my senior year in high school. Peggy Bus 39, you should know her by now. She knew my name, my schedule, where I lived. She took me not only to and from school, but to every athletic event I participated in and field trip. It's critical that we have the best people, like Peggy, to transport our most precious cargo, our kids. Children need consistency in their lives, and what better way to show consistency than to have the same bus drivers, chaperones, paras, food service, and other staff year to year. It's no coincidence that after the fall, after the UI change, for the first time in a long time, you did not hear about the back-to-school staffing crisis in the news.
And time, I'm sorry.
During the COVID lockdowns, people were falling all over themselves to tell us how much they appreciated our work. But for most people, it was just lip service.
And I'm sorry, I do have to cut you off. Ms. Scott and Meg Luger Nikolai. Thank you. Ms. Scott, if you'll state your name for the record, and please proceed.
First, good afternoon. My name is Kristen Scott, and I'm a special education paraprofessional in the Elk River School District. In 2023, the legislature provided historic funding in some very specific areas like paid family medical leave for all employees, earned sick and safe time, training for paraprofessionals, and unemployment insurance for hourly school workers. The changes suggested in HF6 would upend these programs that make our schools better and provide stability for workers like me. We are paraprofessionals. We ride on buses and work as crossing guards to make sure your children arrive safely at school. We supervise study halls, lunchrooms, playgrounds, and media centers. We go to classes. We sit with students who need extra help so a teacher can concentrate on teaching a class. We read tests aloud, reteach lessons, hold hands, push wheelchairs, fix zippers, tie shoes, change briefs, change feeding tubes, document behaviors, track assignments and test scores, schedule IEP meetings, fill out third-party billing forms. We work with students from preschool age to 22 years old. We feed students lunches while scrambling to find time to eat our own lunches and take our own bathroom breaks. We do English and algebra and chemistry and biology and history and all the other classes for all the grade levels. We wash hands and wipe noses. We know what to do in case of a seizure. We walk with the slowest and keep up with the fastest. We're kicked, punched, pinched, bitten, sworn at, and called names. We build trust. We mediate, we comfort, we're trained in CPI, first aid, CPR, suicide prevention, and ALICE. We must be highly qualified with a college degree or skills testing by our districts. We scramble every day to cover everything because we're almost always shorthanded. And when one of us gets sick, we rarely get a sub. And every day we come back and do it all again because your children are important to us. They are why we do what we do. I received my first paycheck of the school year on October 5th after working for an entire month. My last full paycheck from the previous school year was on June 20th. Unemployment helps me bridge the gap in the summer so that I can come back in the fall and do the important job of helping your children thrive.
And
HF6 would allow districts to move these dedicated funds with no oversight. If you want great outcomes for your kids,
I'm sorry.
You need to ensure support for the people who are teaching them, feeding them, and caring for them every day. Thank you.
And William Schwant, you'll be up next.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Meg Luger-Nikolai, and I am an attorney for Education Minnesota, where we represent 85,000 school professionals. We oppose House File 6, which permits districts to use dedicated revenue approved by this legislature in a game of what seems like three-card Monty with no apparent accountability to the legislature, the state, or to residents of their own districts. This is revenue that's already been part of a budgeting process that was supposed to have been made transparent to residents in truth and taxation hearings, for example, which will probably have to be called something else if the legislature intends to enable districts to allocate funds without any oversight. This year alone, we've observed numerous instances of districts refusing to release allocated funds for teachers' compensation and stipends, notwithstanding the fact that my organization and MSBA created what were essentially turnkey memoranda to facilitate compliance with that law. Unfortunately, this demonstrates that even with MSBA's guidance and plain instructions, some districts can't responsibly administer allocated funds. It is especially troubling that notwithstanding the voter information that is required on ballots and provided to voters regarding proposed operating levies, this bill would enable districts to move operating funds, for example, to construction budgets or administrative pay increases. It interacts with Minnesota Statute 205A.07, which requires the posting of an accurate sample ballot, including the purposes of a revenue increase. The Elections Committee of this body should determine whether it's possible to comply with state election procedures and or permit a future school board to pull the rug out from under voters. The only limitation in the bill right now is that transfer should not increase property taxes. Finally, this bill is ill-timed when a number of charter schools have demonstrated terrible financial controls and vulnerability to charlatans, and school districts are resisting full implementation of the READ Act and resisting implementation of unemployment insurance for their seasonal staff, some of their lowest paid employees. This rewards their recalcitrance, and compliant districts already know how to budget appropriately. This bill should land in other committees. It shouldn't go to the floor without additional review. And fast-tracking it and is time. A sign that some folks are afraid of sunlight.
Thank you for your testimony. And William Schwant and Laura Carpenter. End of the test fires. I know it feels like a little competition with the time. I'm trying to make sure the members have a chance to really vet their conversation and support your comments. So that's the end goal. William Schwant? Okay. Laura Carpenter and Natasha Doctor. You could. Ms. Carpenter, if you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Laura Carpenter. I am an organizer with SEIU, a former school nutrition worker, and today I am testifying as a mom. And I'm concerned that the changes allowed in this bill would negatively impact my child. For most of my kids' education, they had to say goodbye to the para that they had grown close to and formed a deep bond with when the para left for the summer job and wouldn't be coming back. I got used to lots of tears at the end of every school year. Because of unemployment insurance, the summer of 2023 was the first time in my kids' education that they didn't have to say goodbye to their para at the end of the school year, and they made tons of progress over the 2 years where they had the same para. 2 years in a row for the first time. These are important jobs, and they make a huge difference in kids' lives, and it takes really special people to do them. How do you individualize education to a student's needs if you don't know my kid? My kid's IEP is long, and because of the staffing crisis, paras are working with many kids who have very complicated support needs. Before the legislature passed paid training for paras, it took months for new paras to get in the groove. Para educators work bell to bell, and before the law changed, their first day was also the student's first day. There was not time to learn all the different supports, and the 6 hours in current law just isn't even enough. We should be expanding training rather than making it optional. Paras need more than 8 hours a year, and every caring adult in the building should get professional development every year. I was a nutrition worker who wanted to do my best, but we were just never trained on any of the like kid-focused stuff, like supporting a kid, and yet we were still interacting with dysregulated kids sometimes in the cafeteria, in the hallway. I'll close by saying that so every time that something goes wrong for my kid at school, it's because they were short-staffed. I'm always on the phone listening to what went wrong, and then I'm expecting them to say, and the para was out sick, or and we were short-staffed today. It's every single time for the past 5 years. These laws like unemployment, earned sick and safe time, and paid family and medical leave, paid training, that this bill rolls back, make it really hard for people to stay in their jobs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Natasha Doctor, did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Natasha Doctor, and I have been a teacher in Minneapolis Public Schools for 9 years. I love being a teacher in Minneapolis and hope to spend my career as an educator. Currently, I serve in a role that we call Teacher on Special Assignment, where I mentor and support teachers who are new to the career, as I am also the first vice president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers and a member lobbyist. As a state, we are at a critical moment for ensuring we retain our educators in the profession. The 2023 legislature provided historic funding in some very specific areas like paid family medical leave for all employees, earned sick and safe time, specific funding to go towards training for paraprofessionals, and to fund more student support personnel in our schools like nurses, psychologists, and counselors, unemployment insurance for hourly school workers. All of these things support us as a profession with the retention of high-quality educators, something we desperately need. I see firsthand every day how these supports have made it so our new educators can see a long-term career for themselves in the profession. Unfortunately, the changes in House File 6 would upend these programs that seek to make our school communities better for students and provide stability for workers. House File 6 would also give districts the authority to have more discretion about how they spend their funds with no oversight from the legislature. The state should be demanding more transparency from school districts and charter school budgets, not less. I know all too well at times when it comes for negotiations, a district often claims to be running a deficit and then shows a different financial picture after bargaining concludes. To close, we need the education profession to be retaining our educators. House File 6 would roll back some of the important progress we have made in retention, which would deeply harm our school communities and students. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Teresa Gringener, make sure I get that right, and Matt Dickenhausen. If I mispronounce those, please let me know. And Mr. Dickenhausen, is that right?
Dickhausen,
you go ahead and start.
All right, thank you. Chair Kreshaw and committee members, thank you for your time. My name is Matt Dickhausen. I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Ed Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in strong opposition of provision House File 6, Article 3, which would allow school districts to transfer community ed fund balances to their general fund. Community ed fund balances are not excess funds. They are carefully managed resources dedicated to specific purposes that benefit students, families, and communities. These funds are essential for maintaining program stability, supporting lifelong learning opportunities, and ensuring financial stability and sustainability for programs all across the state. I want to emphasize the importance of maintaining these dedicated funds for several key reasons. One is fiscal stability and responsibility. Community ed programs rely on these reserves to mitigate fluctuations in enrollment and participation, ensuring that critical services remain available regardless of external economic pressures. Future investments. These funds support long-term planning, such as capital projects, facility and equipment improvements, and expanded programming that meet the evolving needs of our communities. Also, emergency preparedness. We've seen firsthand how essential these reserves are in responding to unexpected events, such as the rapid mobilization of free childcare services during the pandemic. Also, we need to preserve the program integrity. Current laws prohibiting fund transfers exist to uphold the integrity and purpose of community education dollars. Allowing these transfers undermines the foundational principles that guide the responsible management of these funds. Redirecting community ed funds to the general fund would threaten to the long-term sustainability of these essential programs. These funds and generated through user fees, local levies, and state aid. Thank you.
Thank you. And Teresa, I'll let you, if you could pronounce your last name.
So Teresa Greniger, unfortunately, is not able to be here in person. I'm hoping I can read a letter on her behalf.
Yep, you have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa. I work as a paraprofessional at King Elementary in Deer River. Paras need support in order to help our kids. The 2023 legislature helped provide that support in specific areas like paid family medical leave, earned sick and safe time, specific funding to go towards training for paras, and unemployment insurance for hourly school workers. The changes proposed in HF6 could drastically change the support. Paras are some of the lowest paid employees at a school, but we play a vital role in supporting students' academic and social growth. I teach essential skills like reading, math, and social skills. For example, one student in two years went from not knowing letter sounds to reading 70 words per minute, thanks to our dedicated efforts. In the 12 years I've been at King, our team has dwindled from 35 to 19 paras across departments. We struggle with retention due to the low income we earn.
Unemployment has been essential in supplementing the income we receive throughout the year. It allows me to prorate my pay from 12 to 9 months, making it possible for me to pay my winter bills. Without it, most paras would not be able to afford working as paras. I asked 5 paras if they could stay without unemployment benefits. All 5 said no. The students I work with need the individualized attention a para can provide. Jeopardizing our financial support systems does more than jeopardize our jobs. It jeopardizes our children's future. We need this funding to ensure we can stay in our jobs. Without it, retention issues will continue to worsen. I urge you to vote against HF6 to protect paraprofessionals and ensure kids have access to the vital service.
Thank you. And if Kim and Katina could come up next. And I'm sorry, Kim, I'm going to ask you to pronounce your name, please. Ms. Taylor, if you'd like to begin, state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you. Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katina Taylor, and I am the president of the ESP's chapter of Minneapolis Federation of Teachers and Educational Support Professionals. The educational support professionals are the first people students greet in the morning and the very last adults they see in the afternoon. We are the most racially diverse group of adults in nearly every school. We are the tutors, the special education aides, and the hall monitors. We keep the buildings clean, serve the food, and have the most trusted relationships with students. Unfortunately, we also have fewer job protections than teachers. We fight for respect in the workplace almost every single day. The changes that HF6 proposes would not give ESPs more stability in their careers. It would give them less. This bill would allow districts to strip away programs like unemployment insurance for hourly school employees, paid family medical leave, and earned sick and safe time. And when it came to the bargaining table, there would be less transparency about school district budgets because of the changes in Article 3, Section 1. This section allows districts to move funds without approval from the legislature, from one pot to the other. While it's true ESPs have made some financial progress thanks to the increases in school funding from the state, we're still struggling. Low pay and rising insurance costs keep ESPs economically stressed, oppressed, and living with dreams deferred. It doesn't matter how much heart and care, support, love that we bring to work for our students, we can't win at this game. Even when we're working extra jobs on nights and weekends, it's too much. One job should be enough. My colleagues are walking away from jobs they believe would help them get ahead. And they're doing it because they're exhausted, disrespected, and broke.
And Ms. Taylor, your passion has won
HF6 would roll back progress for ESPs and make it harder for us to afford our lives. Say no. Please vote no on HF6. Thank you.
Thank you. And Kim?
Chair and members, my name is Kim Kaniakua. I'm a paraeducator in the Fridley School District and a member of SEIU Local 284. I'm here to talk about the importance of requiring there to be paid training for paras. The role of our paraeducators in our school is an important one. Our paras work in a large variety of roles with some of our most vulnerable students in our schools. To ask someone to walk in on day one and learn on the job creates an unsafe situation for students and staff alike. Just as importantly, it's impossible for us to support students to learn, grow, and become more independent if we don't know their goals and education plan. Requiring paid training has meant that our paras can start with students with a general knowledge of what they need to do to perform in their role. They have time to read IEPs and talk with their supervising teacher about how to support students' goals to help work towards independence. They can find out who to talk to when they have questions, because let's face it, there will be a lot of questions. Our jobs are really hard. They change, and we are required to adapt a lot with those changes. Even with a required training, it's not enough. I've been doing this job for 22 years, and I'm still learning every day. Since the pandemic, our schools have had a hard time finding and keeping people in para roles. The more knowledge we can give people prior to starting with their students, the more likely they are to be able to perform their job and also want to stay. We owe it to our students to give the staff working with them the tools to do their job confidently so they want to stay and be a consistent and caring adult in the lives of our students. When I first started working as a para, I had answered an ad in a paper. At the time, we received a lot of training surrounding autism, which was good and important, but we now know that to best serve our students and meet the entire range of student needs, we need a lot more training in de-escalation strategies, trauma, mental health, just to name a few. Instead of talking about making paid training optional for districts, we should be talking about how to give more training. Our students deserve that. I was a stay-at-home mom when I started as a para. I fell in love and I stayed. I want others in my role to have the tools they need to want to stay too. Taking away a required paid training prior to day one with students will significantly impact how confident paras are in their role. Confident, skilled paras are essential to our schools. It's what our students deserve. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, right on time. And thank you for your testimony. Akilah Robertson. And Tiffany Dietrich, we have one addition. Robertson, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Dr. Akilah Robertson, Policy Director at Education Evolving, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that drives transformational student-centered designs for learning. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of innovation in Minnesota public education, specifically the Innovation Zones provision and House File 6. Dr. Mae Jamison, the first African-American female astronaut, once said, "The future never just happened, it was created." And Innovation Zones help to create enriched educational journeys with a promising future for our students. Education Evolving led a coalition of organizations and districts that advocated for the original between 2012 and 2017. We support the concept of innovation zones and celebrate the transformations that they helped to produce. There were 6 zones created under Minnesota's 2017 law and 4 under the 2012 law. One example of an innovation zone is Tri-District Community Education, a partnership between the school districts of South St. Paul, Emigrant Heights, and West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Eagan. This collaboration created and supported opportunities for students that included the Center for Advanced Professional Studies program, a collaboration with businesses and community partners that enhance and deepen the authenticity of the learning experiences to stimulate and hone career interest. In closing, this provision allows district leaders to collaborate at a time when problem solving together is critical. Thank you for your time.
And thank you, Dr. Robertson, and I appreciate the pronunciation. And Ms. Dietrich, I apologize, I missed you the first time through, so.
That's okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Kreisha and committee members. My name is Tiffany Dietrich, and I'm a proud public educator of 29 years. I'm here today to speak in opposition to the authority proposed by Article 3 of 6. In 2023, the legislature strengthened schools by funding paraprofessional training and increasing student support personnel like nurses, psychologists, and counselors. They made historic investments in Minnesota's workers by establishing paid family leave and earned sick and safe time. These investments are life-changing for educators like my colleague Cassie, who gave me permission to share her story. Cassie's son Jackson was born in 2020, just as her husband started a new career in law enforcement. With no accrued leave or parental leave, he returned to work just 3 days after her emergency C-section, leaving Cassie to care and recover, care for her newborn and recover alone. After a miscarriage, Cassie had to ration her limited leave. When her second son, Riggins, was born prematurely in 2021, she exhausted her sick time. When his weight and nutrition became a concern, Cassie faced an impossible choice: take unpaid leave for critical follow-up care or afford basic necessities for her family. Should implementation of paid family leave be delayed, other families may face this same impossible choice in the future. Minnesotans like Cassie need the legislature to keep fixing a broken system, not make it worse. Every day, students and the educators I serve as president of White Bear Lake Area Educators feel the effects of Minnesota's growing teacher shortage. HF6 would only worsen that crisis by allowing districts to delay paid family leave and transfer funds without oversight, reducing transparency and accountability, which harms students, parents, and educators. For these reasons and more, I urge you to vote no on HF 6.
And thank you for your testimony. And with that, Mr. Uni. And thank you to all the testifiers. Mr. Uni, I'm going to call you up. And we did have one person who was not here, so you can have 4 minutes today. 350. 350 if you roll your eyes again. I've had kids, and
Mr.
so do you.
Mr. Chair, was eyebrows raised, not...
Well, Mr. Uni, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Minnesota Department of Education, and I appreciate the opportunity here to provide some comments on HF 6. Many of you who are in education policy may have heard some of these themes, but I think it's bare. First, I want to be clear, MDE always remains open to partnering on improvements to our education system, but I do want to highlight some concerns we have with the proposals in HF 6. And first, I want to say we have serious concerns about the fund transfer and relief from mandates proposal in Article 3. Allowing all of our local education agencies to individually choose which laws to follow and not follow could create a confusing patchwork of different expectations from school to school and district to district. We risk losing a lot of oversight and accountability for the use of state funds and consistent expectations around the education we provide Minnesota students. For example, what would this mean for students and families for areas like the consistent provision of school meals, literacy, charter school oversight and finance accountability reforms, non-exclusionary discipline, compensatory revenue uses, English learner services, advances for American Indian students, and compliance with the authority of our Office of General Inspector Inspector General Investigations on AIDS and Grants, as well as MDE oversight and monitoring. MDE would find it extremely difficult to offer guidance on the infinite possibilities of fund transfer not follow particular state laws and rules. This would result in significant confusion and result in compliance issues, as well as possible liability for our LEAs, local education agencies, making these decisions. How impactful and meaningful would the other proposals in the bill related to the READ Act and the performance reporting system be when LEAs have a vastly different set of expectations? This may set a troubling precedent. Second, I want to make clear our deep concern with eliminating funding for our EDI Center. This funds the work of dedicated professionals focused on a number of areas critical to our students, including supporting comprehensive mental health, school safety, achievement and integration, school nurses, discipline, restorative practices, physical health, social-emotional learning, and bullying prevention. The EDI Center also administers and manages many grants that school leaders who have the lack of funding rely on to offset the costs that support student achievement and safety. To effectively execute these grants, our LEA grantees need someone with expertise they cannot contact for assistance and guidance. Eliminating the funding for these hardworking staff will ultimately have a dramatic impact on our students, staff, and families statewide that they tirelessly support on a daily basis. On the READ Act, we do want to partner with the committee to make sure the bill's language aligns with what districts are implementing. And we have some concerns about a capacity at MDE should the CARI partnership be terminated to complete the tasks and provide ongoing support. This could require up to 4 FTE to cover this work. Regarding the language around the Office of Achievement and Innovation, much of what is in the bill is already work being done every day by our dedicated Compass team. I would ask the committee to be mindful of the impact that reorganization requirements of the agency would have on the services and support MDE provides direct to the field. Nearly all of the elements of the new performance report are already on the Minnesota report card as required by statute, and we have extensive responsibilities to report set out by the federal Every Student Succeeds Act. We welcome continued conversations in this space about what we can provide. But I want to note that a new reporting system, especially one that would be put up by July 1st of 2026, would carry a cost, especially if it's on a timeline of 1 year. We do look forward to working with the committee on workable solutions for Minnesota students, educators, families, and appreciate the opportunity to provide comments on HF6.
And thank you, Mr. Uni. And just so everyone knows, I do have a tremendous amount of respect. Please stay close by because I'm sure you might be called up again. And thank you very much. And I very much appreciate the sentiment and the truthfulness of wanting to work with the committee members. So we look forward to that. Representative Mueller and Representative Bakeford, if you would come back. And the first person I have on the list is Representative Sensenmiura. And I actually have
Mr. Chair, actually, could I ask a question first?
Oh, sure. Chair Uakim.
Thank you. So I was a little caught by the surprise at the beginning that we're moving this to the floor.
quite a few fiscal impacts from either even just the basic IT work that for the report card. Let's see, there was in Article 1, there was the requiring PALSBY to do work, fund transfers, and you heard from Mr. Uni having MDE try to track all 331 school districts and what they're doing, where the money is going, definitely has fiscal notes. I don't understand why you're not parking it in Ways and Means. That would make more sense, especially if it's going to back there when it has a fiscal note. If this is going to be a vehicle bill, because hopefully we hear each of these three sections separately, which you and I have talked about, then just say it's a vehicle bill, but it still should sit in Ways and Means because it needs a fiscal note. So I'm little disappointed in that. What I would like to do is, I know it's been different in every committee about whether or not the non-voting member can make a motion. I know I can't vote on a bill, but I would ask you if I could make motions, otherwise assign people to make those motions that we'd like to make right now.
Yep, and if you'd like to do that, we can have Representative Clardy make the motion.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Unless you have another one.
Yes, I do. I think Representative Lee has the motion first. Or Representative Sensenmura. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Sensenmura. Yeah.
Thank you. I was going to say, you're acknowledged by the chair.
Representative Sensenmura.
Yeah, thank you. Motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and I will say that as a mom that's back to work after 6 weeks, particularly sensitive and right for me right now, but you know, I'm really concerned about a lot of the labor protections and rollbacks in this bill. So I would like to make a motion to re-refer it to the workforce committee. I think that if we are going to make it, educators are the only people in our state that don't have paid leave, that don't have earned sick and safe time, that don't have unemployment insurance, then we really need to be having that conversation in the Workforce and Economic Development Committee. So that is my motion.
And so, Representative Sensenmura, you'd like to amend the motion to re-refer House File 6 as amended to the Committee on Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development.
Yes,
is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would like to ask for a roll call for that, too.
And Representative Sensenmura requests a roll call. And members, House File 2 and House File 3028, which were the predecessors in the last session, did not come through this committee. And so by bringing them through here, we're just paying respects to those mandates, even though they affect the schools. And so I would be opposed to that. And with that, the clerk will take the roll. Representative Lee, would you like to speak?
Session on the minute. Yeah, I was just going to say, I believe this is a debatable motion, so I don't know if the author had anything to say or if any other on this.
Would you like to, Representative Lee?
Yeah, please. I think the one thing that I would just note for folks is, you know, particularly in elementary school, we have a workforce that is predominantly women. But I'd like to note that when administrators get to negotiate their contracts, they get to negotiate in paid leave and all of these other benefits. And so I just want to highlight the disparity between, you know, what we're doing to our workforce, which is predominantly women who have kids, right? And in our country has I think I have the mic back. You know, we have a an aging population now, and also we have a retention problem, right, in our workforce. And so I just want to note that, and this is why, you know, this having this discussion in the Workforce and Labor Committee is so important to us.
Okay. Further discussion on the Sensenmura amendment motion? If not, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Carisha?
No.
Bakeberg?
No.
Altendorf?
No.
Bonner?
Yes.
Bennett?
No.
Colardi?
Yes.
DePell?
No.
Engen?
No.
Green?
Yes.
Hill?
Yes.
Hudson?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Lee?
Yes.
Knudsen?
No.
Lawrence?
No.
Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Perez Vega?
Perez Vega, yes.
Quam?
No.
Ream?
Yes.
Ray Rauer?
Yes.
Reimer?
No.
Sensenmura?
Yes.
Vernig?
Yes.
And with 11 With 12 nays and 11 ayes, the motion does not prevail, and the current motion remains in place for House File 6. Did you have another one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some more questions.
Okay. Back to you, or you want to go to member questions?
Member questions for now. Thank you.
And do you want me to go to the list?
Yep.
Okay. The first person I have on the list is Representative Sensor Muir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, authors of the bill, for starting this conversation. You know, as I mentioned with my motion, I'm very concerned, and I think a lot of testimony today from educators across our state echoes those concerns around the labor protection. So I'm wondering if the authors can speak to if this paid leave, family leave date is pushed back for 3-4 years, right? And we have educators who are the only people in our state that are not getting some of these protections, including time off to care for themselves or their family. How do you see that interacting with the teacher retention problem, which I know we've spoken about as a committee? I know that you all are aware of that problem and are. If educators are the only people in the state that do not get to have these labor protections, do you think that will affect our teacher shortage or educator shortage?
And to the testifiers who would like to take that, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and very good question. First of all, the delays would allow school districts to implement these appropriately and hopefully afford them. I would just put out the proposal here that if we don't do delays or allow for delays, and they don't have to, but if we allow for that, our schools are going to be able to keep more of their employees. We already know, and we've heard from all of your districts, they are in dire straits financially. They are in deficits. They are cutting staff. They are cutting programs. So we could very well lose many, many teachers. Therefore, the teacher retention becomes a little bit of a struggle because we're already losing them. So we have to look at the balance of this. I don't see a problem with allowing for postponement, staggering implementation of all of these. And these are negotiated items within schools already and have been for years. And I feel like this is a good proposal to allow districts to actually keep more staff, which is retention. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sensenmuir, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett, for that answer. You know, I would just say that, you know, I think you asked why can't we just delay? You know, I think we all know that life happens to us, right? So we can't delay potentially having our children. We can't delay having to take care of a sick parent. So I believe that we will lose teachers for this, and I'm really concerned about that provision. Thank you.
And Representative Sensenmuir, I have you on the list twice. Do you want to go to Article 2 right away as well?
Yeah, I will go. So this is actually a question for Mr. Uni.
Mr. Uni, if you come back up. And if the pages, could you find one more chair for the test first?
It's fine. It's not a big deal for me to move.
Okay. Mr. Uni, welcome back. Representative Sensenmuir?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a question for MDE. I think you spoke a little bit about it in your testimony, but just all of the things that the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Center is doing for school districts and schools across our state. You know, I heard, I think, a lot of things that I would relate generally to school climate. You know, it's a huge, huge issue. Mental health for students, support with anti-bullying, restorative practices. So can you talk about some of the kind of direct school supports that would be cut if we had to cut this department and this funding? And I guess a question maybe for Mr. Uni or to the bill authors, do you see some of those supports rolling into this new office, or would it be to these services that are vital for our schools? Thank you.
And thank you for the concise questions. Mr. Uni, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sensenmuir, thanks for the question. I'll just focus on two. Okay, so this mic doesn't like me either. It can be kind of applied, the concepts applied across the range of areas that I mentioned in my testimony. This division houses our school nurse and our comprehensive mental health specialist. These two members are part of a comprehensive mental health or health framework that we engage in. And so that also includes safe and supportive schools, that also includes bullying prevention. And these two individuals specifically provide statewide leadership to our support personnel, especially around nurses and mental health specialists in the state. And so they provide seminars around the state. They help develop the guidance that our locals rely on, our professionals rely on a daily basis. This provides up-to-date national research, as well as help understand even of our students and how to weave programs together. Not only do they work with in their specific lanes and areas as it pertains to school nurse for nursing or comprehensive mental health services or bullying prevention, but they also weave together a lot of the work across the agency to help infuse the guidance that we put out for districts with those concepts. We know that mental health and student well-being undergirds just a well-rounded education and students' access to a well-rounded education. When our students are cared for, they perform better, and we believe that unsiloed work across the agency is critical to. And so even direct, even outside of the day-to-day impact that they directly have with students, educators, our school leaders, they have a direct impact on the work that many of our other divisions do that then translates into day-to-day impact for our students and educators.
Representative Sensenmeyer, follow-up.
I had the question for the bill author, too, so I would love to hear from your perspective. Do you imagine that some of those vital services would move into this new office if this bill was...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sensenmeyer. Congratulations. So I think you have to understand the reality of what happens at school on a day-to-day basis. So we need to start with that. So prior to this office, educators were still making sure that kids' physical needs, their health needs were being taken care of. We were addressing mental health of students. We were addressing bullying. We were addressing school discipline. Prior to this office being there, we were already talking about non-exclusionary discipline. So all of those pieces, we were already doing at the school level. And to be very, very honest, PBIS is a very common piece that you've heard. That has morphed into non-exclusionary discipline. The best training on PBIS was not from the department, with all due respect. The best training from educators was from other educators. And that is what educators are asking for. So achievement and innovation, of course, many of these pieces would be a part of it, minus the divisive practices that this office has been pushing. And I would just invite you to go back and talk to your local districts. Don't take my perspective on it. Go back and talk to your local districts, because one of the biggest frustrations for educators is that we are put in the middle of situations that are lose-lose. Depending on the perspective that the district takes, they're going to have half of their constituency be upset and half be happy. And you flip that, and that happens on a day-to-day basis. I'll give you one example. So when non-exclusionary discipline was passed during the 23 session, there were members of the, and I won't name them out of respect, Mr. Uni, but there were members from the EDI Center that were holding listening sessions. Multiple principals were shamed and disrespected during those sessions. Then, after it passed, at Breezy Point, when MASSP had their summer conference, I was driving up to speak to the group. I got phone calls and texts as I was driving about the disrespectful behavior from staff at the EDI Center. My first phone call was to Mr. Uni. So do I think that this is going to impact kids? I think our school districts are doing an amazing job supporting kids on a daily basis. And I'll stop with that so you can.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. And just remind members, we have about 15 minutes for questions. These conversations are great, and I really want to keep them moving. Representative Muir, do you have a follow-up, or can I move on?
You can move on.
Okay. Representative Lee, then Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Mr. Uni wants to. I actually had a follow-up. On that line of question. Actually, I have two questions. And I know Representative Bakebert gave one example of divisive policies that this department is pushing, but I don't know if Mr. Uni wants to respond to that or talk about the policies that this office has successfully been able to implement to make sure that our students have access to social emotional learning and have safe schools.
Mr. Uni.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee. I'm not sure I need to, I mean, yes, it's true that Representative Bakebert called me and we had a discussion and been able to have conversations and relay the concerns to the commissioner and other assistant commissioners, and open dialogue about how the department delivers our services is always important. We're a continuous improvement entity, and we want to take that work very seriously, and we want to make sure that the content and the message on behalf of our students and educators is always received in the most productive manner so that educators can get to work on behalf of our students. And if that happens to account for open dialogue and real talk about how the message is delivered, we're open for it. So appreciate also highlighting that for us here, and we'll take it back as well. In terms of the successful work that the department has across a range of the items that I've talked about in terms of updating our student code of conduct, providing an update for our safe and supportive schools, resources for schools in general to implement our bullying prevention laws, bringing on board our school nurse, our comprehensive mental health specialist, as well as creating, and I mentioned this earlier, but I can't, and I'm happy to provide some backup information. I think maybe in the last session or the session before, we provided a presentation on our comprehensive mental health framework that we started putting together about 3 years ago, really launched 2 years ago. And I'm happy to go back and get an update on kind of what the implementation indicators are for that in terms of success of the number of guidance meetings that we had, as well as the results that we're seeing from there. But one of the things I wanted to point out that in the field, and I know the professionals of the department believe that the educators in the field are some of the best deliverers of best practices. And one of the ways we get to having them do that is train the trainer model. And what we've done with funds, state funds, what we've done with federal funds before and during the pandemic is really leverage that train the trainer model, where we have experts at the department who really have the time outside of the classroom to be able to get that national research and focus on implementation guidance to be able to set up programs for train the train model. So we've done that in non-exclusionary discipline. We've done that in safe and supportive schools. We've done that in social emotional learning, and really give the educators in the field the tools they need to be able to implement those practices and educate their colleagues. And it is about being able to tweak and to reform, not reform, to tweak and to change it a little bit to meet the needs at the, for their local
school. Representative Lee, quick follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. No, I would just say, you know, Rep. Bakebert is absolutely right. That we had, that teachers have been dealing with mental health of students for a very long time. But I would note that mental health has become a heightened issue for parents and teachers alike because, you know, mental health among students is at one of its lowest points that we've ever seen. And so, you know, this is why the work of this department is so incredibly important, right? And we just went through a pandemic, and this is partially why we see chronic absenteeism, because our kids are still not over this, even though, you know, other policymakers might want us to get over the pandemic. And so, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bonner, then Representative Rehrauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Commissioner Jett is not here today, so I'm guessing Mr. Uni might be best qualified to answer my questions. I do have a series of questions, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to make them more succinct depending on the answers
and
I get.
Representative Bonner, I do have six on the list, so.
I'll do my best. I guess my first system is on Article 2, Section 1, and some of these are really quick, by the way. Is this a new or existing system that we're creating for the reporting?
To the testifiers. Mr. Uni, I'm sorry, that was for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so we're looking at Article two. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure that I'm speaking to the right one. There we go. On the school performance report. So this appears to us, and our team is currently looking at I believe Chair has mentioned that a fiscal note has been requested, so I imagine our team is looking at it. The way we've read it and the initial comments that I've received is that this is asking for a new system. I do not have the specifics from Minute in terms of what that would entail. I will say, as I mentioned in my comments, this does contain a range of items that we do already have on a report card, but based on testimony from the authors in both committees, this does appear like this would be a new system that we're being asked to create.
Representative Bonner.
Okay, thank you. You might have answered one of my other questions about consulting with Minute. In terms of this new report, you have some of the data elements already. Do we know if there's any barriers for sharing of the data of these particular elements?
Ms. Journey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so obviously there's difference of opinion in terms of the user-friendly nature of our Minnesota report card as well as our data center. So there's two areas where you can get this information. It's our data center where you can pull spreadsheets, and then there's our Minnesota report card, which I think is a user-friendly model for displaying all the way down to the site level what student performance is across a range of indicators for performance in a range of different areas like reading and math, but across grade levels, across multiple assessments, as well as across different types of student groups. You can really dive down if you want to, or you can get an overall proficiency or achievement level for any of these subjects. Proficiency on state assessments is available. The student attendance is available. It is on a different timeline than due to local and state validation requirements as well as data privacy requirements. Graduation rates are on there. I think obviously it's up to debate about the plain language writing of it, but the current system does include all of these data points that are here. Maybe there's a difference of opinion in terms of the expectation of what that would look like. But again, the way this is written is it would look like we would be needing to do a new system.
Representative Bonner.
Last follow-up. I'll just skip ahead a little bit. So I have a little bit of concern on this, and I'm just going to be I'll just spell it out here for the sake of time. But the implementation date, as I see it, is July 1, 2026. That's a pretty tight turnaround for a brand new system. Two, it does not look like we have a fiscal note at this time. And I know the chair mentioned that we're getting one. But they are notorious for not having a great amount of detail. So I'm curious about the cost of this. I know this, if I understood the path correctly, this is going straight to the floor rather than to Waze or rather to anywhere else, which means we really don't know what this is going to cost. We don't know if that implementation date is realistic. I did see in the section here, I think it was around 211 or something, some figures, and there's specifically some items called out around updating the mainframe, for example. And if this system is pulling from the mainframe, and we have a series of updates that need to be done for the mainframe before we could even get to this report, that means that the timeline for this is completely unrealistic. And I'm just trying to be really clear about that. As a 30-year technologist, I literally manage the teams who create these things. Not to mention, if you're talking about mainframe, there's very few people who even study mainframe anymore, so finding one, good luck. And so I'm just really concerned that with this report, that we don't have a fiscal note. We have no details for a minute on how they're going to create this report, how they're going to implement it, if they have a vendor, if that's internal or external. There's nothing here about how we could address issues around data or barriers to actually collecting this data and sharing this data, or even if the infrastructure is even capable of doing what they're asking it to do. So I guess for that reason, Mr. Chair, I have real concerns about this particular thing. And I would actually suggest that, you know, perhaps this needs to be laid over because we need to know what these details are. We need a fiscal note in order to even begin to assess whether this is even realistic.
Thank you, Representative Bonner.
So my motion is to lay it over.
Representative Bonner makes a motion to lay the bill over. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair, can we have a recall? Roll call.
Representative Lee has requested a roll call. Oh, and excuse me, and the motion is to lay the bill on the table,
Mr.
not to
Chair,
lay the bill over. Excuse me.
Actually, I think
it's not debatable, okay. But Representative Lee has a and if you want to make a clarification, I want to get this right.
I think it would be maybe more to move to lay it on the well. Before we take your motion, could we have a motion from Representative Lee? Could you withdraw your motion, Representative Bonner?
Representative Lee, would you like to withdraw your roll call? Let's just back this up.
Okay, back up. Yeah,
sure.
And can Representative withdraw Lee the roll call. Withdraws the roll call. Representative Bonner, would you like to withdraw your motion and make a new one?
Sure. My motion. No,
it was Representative Lee.
Sorry.
Doesn't matter.
Sorry, I'm getting confused.
This is what makes it hard when I can't make a motion, even though I'm a member of this committee.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I will make a motion to refer this to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Bonner amends the motion to go to the Ways and Means Committee. Is that correct?
Yes.
Representative Bonner amends the motion to the Ways and Means. Representative Lee, would you like a roll call?
Yes, Chair, I would like to request a roll call vote.
Roll call has been called. Discussion. And the clerk will take the roll.
Kreisha.
No.
Bakeberg.
No.
Altendorf.
No.
Bonner.
Yes.
Bennett.
No.
Pilardi.
Yes.
DePauw.
No.
Engen.
No.
Green.
Yes.
Hill.
Yes.
Hudson.
No.
Johnson.
Yes.
Lee.
Yes.
Knutson.
Nope.
Lawrence.
No.
Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Perez Vega.
Yes.
Quam.
Nine.
Representative Quam, could you please do that in English?
Yes.
I'm sorry, back to Representative Quam. You could have him do it in English.
Quam?
Please. No.
Thank you.
Ream.
Yes.
Ray Rauer.
Yes.
Reimer.
No.
Censor Murrah.
Yes.
Burning.
Yes.
Seeing 12 nays and 11 ayes, the motion does not prevail. And the motion the motion to go to the General Register stands. Representative Ray Rauer and then Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair. My question is for the paraprofessionals that testified today. So our paraprofessionals and all of our education support professionals are on the front lines with our kids every day. They're often the ones spending the most time with our most vulnerable kids. I started teaching in 1999, and most of the paraprofessionals I worked with at that time worked 8 hours a day, and their wages and benefits made it a viable career. Unfortunately, this has eroded over time. And with this erosion, we have had a huge shortage of paraprofessionals and education support professionals today. Most work 6 hours or less per day, which leads to salaries of $16,000 to $25,000 a year. The bills such as paid training time and unemployment insurance have finally given our paraprofessionals a feeling of respect that this is a career. My question for you is, how does HF6 help with the paraprofessional and education support professional shortage?
And Representative Ray Rauer, did you have a question or is that just a comment?
That was a question.
And the question was for?
The paraprofessionals that testified.
There was a lot.
Which one would you like to have come back up? And while you're doing that, members, Kristen, I have a request
Scott,
to go a couple more minutes long. I do have members that are going to have to go to other committees, so I can allow us to go 10 minutes and be very tight, but I'm going to need us to really tighten up things. So, Ms. Dietrich?
Yep, that'd be great.
Thank you. Ms. Dietrich?
The question was, how does this...
Representative Ray Rauer. Representative Ray Rauer, please restate your question.
How does this bill, HF6... help with the paraprofessional shortage and education support professional shortage that we are facing today?
Ms. Dietrich, to the question.
I believe that this might be the first year in 19 years that I've worked with an almost full staff, and the unemployment benefits in the summer have helped tremendously with that. The fact that we had a full day of training before is still not enough. The amount of what we do every day is a lot, and it's hard to even train the people in the limited amount of time we have to do what we're going to be faced with every day. But I speak with, I represent our union as the vice president and our local union, and there are a lot of people who are considering not coming back this year because they don't know how they're going to survive the summer without pay. And like I said, I'm at the top of the pay scale. I've been doing this for 19 years, and I still by myself don't make enough money to meet the level of income that it says that I should make to be a person that lives and works in Hennepin County or Sherburne County or Anoka County or Wright County or any of the counties represented by my school district.
Thank you.
Representative Ray Rauer, follow up.
Thank you. So just pointing out, you're saying that the bills that were previously passed in 2023 and 2024 that gives you unemployment insurance and gives you paid training time are helpful with the shortage, but this bill today, are you saying, would not be helpful?
Correct.
Okay.
Ms. Dietrich, is that your answer correct?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hill, then Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question for Mr. Uni. This is regarding the EDI.
Mr. Center. Uni?
In the transition here on line 2029, shift to the Office of Achievement and Innovation. The description you offered for the EDI Center was pretty direct about some of the talents and special skill sets that it requires to achieve, to do that work. And my question is, will the employees be shifting to this new office? Is it going to be a new set of employees? And if that, well, we'll start there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, thanks for the question. It's a good question, and it's one for leadership to consider should this go through. We know that these staff members were brought on the team because of their deep expertise in their issue areas, their dedication to the field and to students for these issue areas. I think that $2 million covers 10 to 13 in FTE. I just can't remember the right number, but it's thereabout. So, you know, those, and that covers a wide range of expertise and focus and relationships that they have with the field. Can they simply be turned over to a different set of work that may not necessarily align with the skills that they get? I'm sure some could. I'm sure some have the experience working in this space. But I would also note in my comments that I mentioned that a lot of the work laid out or proposed in the bill is also done by our Compass team, our Minnesota MTSS Compass team that does that work. So is there space for there? We would have a lot of tough questions in terms of how to align that work. But in addition to serving our students, we also want to maintain the professionals and team members that we have. So we would obviously work really hard to make sure that the tasks that they have are aligned with their work. But we want to make sure that they're set up for success to be able to deliver the best for our students and our educators.
And thank you for that, Mr. Ernie.
Quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up, Representative Hill.
Thank you. And, you know, just wondering if there's, you know, a representative for the bargaining unit. My assumption would be it's MAPE that can speak to some of the concerns that these employees may harbor.
And while she's doing that, I'll be going Representative Clardy, Representative Johnson, Representative Vernig, and closing with you, Akeem. We do have to be on our way out of here within about 7 minutes so that the next committee can set up. So with that, to the testifier, please state your name and provide an answer.
Chair Kreshaw and committee members, for the record, my name is Sydney Spreck, and I am a political affairs coordinator at MAPE. MAPE is a union of over 18,500 state workers across all of Minnesota's agencies, boards, and commissions. To your question, Representative Hill, MAPE has strong concerns with the impact of the language in H.
on EDI center staff, which we represent. The bill language is unclear on what will happen to those hardworking staff who currently tackle the important issues discussed previously. These staff oversee the distribution, application, and outcomes of important funding streams from the Minnesota state government. Diverting funding from the EDI Center to a new office means that staffing for oversight and administration of these programs is no longer ensured. Typically, legislation would include a section regarding transition of authority or employees, but Article 2, Section 7, Subdivision 2 includes no language covering this.
Thank you. Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair. So we all agree that urgency of great reading instruction is needed. And Rep. Mueller talked about how literacy scores are going down. So my concerns about the delay that's within it, or that some schools are given the choice of not implementing mandates. So why not just identify specific times in the READ Act or modify those that people are having a difficulty meeting?
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say for right now, how the bill is written right now, we've heard from schools they can't comply at all. And therefore, since they can barely comply with what's written here with the amount of funds that we've been giving them and the timeline that we've been giving them, having them have some sort of flexibility with some more funding will actually apply them, allow them to actually apply and do the READ Act with fidelity.
So how do you specifically plan on helping them?
Senator Mueller.
Well, as, thank you, Mr. Chair. As we've laid out in the bill, we want, number one, we want to make sure, as we will send this through by itself, we want to make sure that it's actually money that will go directly to the schools instead of to Cary. When we decide to sever the relationship with Cary, we'll be able to actually give a little bit more direction as a legislature to MDE on how they're able to approve curriculum and approve professional development. We have seen, and if you want to look, I don't have time to get into it, but there's lots of curriculum that has been stifled because of whatever is going on between the relationship with MDE and Cary. And being able to give them a little bit more flexibility to have something that will work with their own districts, but also hold fast to the science of reading will allow us to actually give the districts that ability to implement this with fidelity, which right now, with the amount of money and the relationship they have with Cary and the relationship that is the strain that is creating on what they are allowed to do, is simply not possible with the bill that you have that is currently in law. It is not possible for them to do it with the amount of money, the strain on the relationship, and the time constraints. It is not possible for them to do. So being able to rectify those things will be able to help them to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Party? Yeah. Representative Johnson, then Vernig, then Chair Youakim. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Krisha. My question, I've got a lot of questions, and part of the frustration.
Representative Johnson, I can give you one.
Yeah, I know it. That's part of the issue is just that this bill obviously encompasses a lot of very in-depth things, and we don't have the time to really get through it or have the fiscal notes to go with it. So some concerns about where and why it's going, where it's going. But my question is specifically to Representative Bakeberg. You had mentioned that fraud is rampant right now. Talking about some of the programs, should we be concerned about how increased flexibility and in turn that decreased accountability could lead to funds being misused or misappropriated and leading to negative outcomes for our students?
Representative Bakeberg.
Obviously, you know, we need to be always concerned about fraud. You just state your question again. I couldn't hear it.
Representative Johnson.
The question would, should we be concerned about how increased flexibility and in turn decreased accountability can lead to funds being misused or misappropriated and leading to negative outcomes for our students?
Representative Bakeberg.
Yeah, I think there's an assumption that our school districts are misusing funds, and quite frankly, you're wrong. If there is a school district that's misusing funds, then they will be held accountable. They have a yearly audit that is public. So I think we have to be very careful, whether it's
me as a legislator or in my administrative role talking about school districts misusing funds. I think we have to be very cautious in saying that. And I get collective bargaining. I negotiate my contract. But when we say things, there are consequences to that. So obviously we want to be concerned about fraud. Let's address fraud. And frankly, we have a pattern in Minnesota that it's not been done well.
Representative Johnson, quick follow-up? Nope. Okay. Representative Vernon, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bakeberg, I do have a question about Article 2 and your student attendance. When subpart 3, are you talking excused or unexcused absences?
Representative Bakeberg.
So it would just be how the school codes attendance. And if we want to have a long attendance conversation, I'd happy to be doing that. But it would right now, the way the language is how the school is coding it. There is obviously the study group. There's attendance bills that you know are moving through. You were part of that pilot. So that language, the clarification around excused and unexcused is an important conversation. But this is how the school currently has it written.
Okay, thank you. I do have a follow-up question.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as a former school board member and somebody who sat on my budget advisory council and a huge advocate for school nurses, I mean, last session we just got the school nurse at MDE, and I want you to understand what that means by that role going away. So more than 50% of the students in the state of Minnesota do not have access to an LSN, as the Minnesota School Nurse Workforce, a 2022 snapshot, pointed out. The school nurse is one of the most talented school nurses I know at MDE. She helps with naloxone, EpiPens, seizure questions, absenteeism. She works with school nurses on respiratory protection questions, radon, vision screening, chronic disease management. She helps with third-party billing, which brings money into your schools. So eliminating that position will cost you money in the long run. She provides some of the best technical assistance you could get from a school nurse. So I'm very opposed to removing that position. Also, as a parent of a child with dyslexia who left first grade and could not read, whose kid goes to private tutoring to learn how, we cannot delay the implementation of the READ Act. I cannot say that.
And I'm sorry, Representative Berg, I do need you to close, please.
Okay. No, all right. So here's my thing. School facilities, we all know roofs and all that is a passion area of mine. Why are we raiding dedicated accounts when there is a way to transfer public funds and a process already in place? This would have detrimental impacts on school facilities. They plan it 10, they have a 10-year plan. So I'm just curious why we're doing that when you can already come and move those funds. We saw both in community ed how having a fund balance helped us in the pandemic, and deferred maintenance is something that takes a long time to do. So can somebody explain to me why we think that's a great idea?
Representative Bakeberg, Representative Bennett. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the concerns regarding reserve accounts and transferring funds. But when we imposed 65 new mandates, more than that actually, on schools, they need some flexibility to put the money where it works so we don't lose staff, so we can retain staff, so we can retain nurses, and all the things that are important to our students. So we need to benefit core academic mission the most. This will allow schools to do that. The decision is accountability is with the local school boards, and the community holds them accountable. So thank you. This will give districts the flexibility they need to run their schools the best that they can.
And thank you for that. And with that, Representative Chair Uakim, I'm going to go to you for the close, and then we'll go.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair Krisha, for allowing us to have a little bit more time. But from the comments around the table, we'd probably need another 2 hours to vet this bill. So hopefully these provisions come back, because we're skipping a lot of steps. We're skipping taxes, because this affects levies as money gets moved around. We're skipping workforce, which could with UI and the interaction with paid family and medical leave, and earned sick and safe leave, could be breaking federal laws, with children and families ignoring mandates, and the money should be going there. And so we chose to be judicious with our time and our motions. We could have also sent this bill to elections, because it's talking about how, as the lawyer from MDE came up, the myriad of laws that this interacts with and what could happen if we allow this absolutely free-for-all flexibility for our schools. Now, I know our schools have been underfunded for 20 years. For those years, there was a 0% increase. We only filled a third of the bucket, and we have an opportunity here to work together to get things done for our schools. So it's been very disappointing to see this is the first bill out of the gate and the trajectory it's taking. This lacks transparency and accountability when it comes to the MDE and the Office of Achievement and Innovation. Great idea, but you're giving a board an ability to say, this is who we're going to go with for a nonprofit without MDE being able to do anything about it. That's unconscionable. And I know 65 is a fun number to say. It's 46, 25 are underfunded or unfunded because they didn't need to be like letting students wear tribal regalia to graduation. So maybe we could start getting together and actually agreeing out what a definition of unfunded mandate is. But with that, I really do want to work together, even though it sounds like I don't. There are some really good ideas in this bill, sections that we could talk about. I absolutely want to look at giving our school districts more flexibility, but not with a sledgehammer, with a scalpel. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will move to lay the bill on the table.
And would you like somebody else to make that motion?
If that is your will, Mr. Chair. Representative Lee.
Thank you, chairs. I move to lay the bill on the table and ask for a roll call vote, please.
And Representative Lee moves to table the bill, lay the bill on the table, and a roll call. Roll call being requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Kreisha.
No.
Bakeberg.
No.
Altendorf.
No.
Bonner.
Yes.
Bennett.
No.
Clardy.
Yes.
DePauw.
No.
Engen.
No.
Green.
Yes.
Hill.
Yes.
Hudson.
No.
Johnson.
Yes.
Lee.
Yes.
Knudsen.
No.
Lawrence.
No.
Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Prez Vega.
Yes.
Quam.
No.
Reem.
Yes.
Ray Rauer.
Yes.
Reimer.
No.
Censor Murrah.
Yes.
Bernig.
Yes.
And with that, the nays 12 and the ayes 11, the motion does not prevail. And with that, Representative Bennett renews her motion that House File 6, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair, can we ask for a roll call on this, please?
I'm sorry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
Can we get a roll call vote on this?
The vote's already been called.
She asked for a roll call ahead of time.
No. I'll back up. We can do a roll call.
Okay.
I'll back up. Representative Lee requests a roll call. Representative Bennett renews her motion that House File 6, as amended, be placed on the general register. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Kreisha.
Aye.
Bakeberg.
Yes.
Altendorf.
Yes.
Bonner.
No.
Bennett.
Yes.
Clardy.
No.
DePauw.
Aye.
Engen.
Yes.
Green.
No.
Hill.
No.
Hudson.
Aye.
Johnson.
No.
Lee.
No.
Knudsen.
Yes.
Lawrence.
Yes.
Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Prez Vega.
No.
Quam.
Aye.
Reem.
No.
Ray Rauer.
No.
Reimer.
Aye.
Censor Murrah.
No.
Vernig.
No.
And with 12 ayes and 11 nays, the motion prevails and is carried. And with that, members, this concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting will be Thursday, February 20th. The committee stands adjourned with my apologies to public safety.